This week on Your Western Context, we look at how polls work and why they can't be trusted. The BC NDP releases ICU info to get people vaccinated, and the Alberta NDP are influencing local municipal candidates. Also, Trudeau's record on housing affordability is in question. This is Western Context, episode 235, recorded Friday, September 10th, 2021. Flipping out. Hello, everybody, and thank you for joining us for another episode of Western Context. Patrick and myself are back this week after taking in a number of the debates this week. I don't know that that'll cause the ratings of the parties to change that much, but lo and behold, it's actually been a quiet news week here, despite everything that's been going on.
Yes, with all of the politicking that's been going on, all of the debates, all of the promises going back and forth, it really is amazing to see that there's not really any huge major news stories this week to talk about that are really needing to be uncovered too much. But nevertheless, we still have a full slate of stories to talk about this week, and some that are definitely needing to be discussed once more as we head in towards the election that is happening on the 20th, and certainly quite a few that bear looking into a little bit further than what the media has done so far.
Yeah, and this is what we do here at Western Context, and we've been doing this since January of 2017. You can find the full show notes at westerncontext.ca, and what we aim to do is remove all the bias and sensationalism that you find in the media. And in doing so, we hope to provide all the information and context necessary to put you, our listeners, on the right side of the news. And in doing that, we need to talk about one of the biggest things that the media loves talking about in these election races, and that is opinion polls. And every election sees a daily deluge of polls, polls that do daily rolling averages, polls that are one-shots, and even less scientific polls that folks carry out online on social media, on Twitter and Facebook. Now, polls can be a useful tool in determining where the public mood is when you ask about specific things, not necessarily all the time about how they're going to vote, because people are far less willing to tell you how they're going to vote compared to how they might feel about various factors regarding the economy, how they're doing in terms of getting ahead, or just in general policies that any level of government has put forward. And there's a lot of folks out there in the media and elsewhere that put a lot of faith in these polls. And what we're going to do with this segment is talk about why it's foolish to treat polls as gospel and to really give them much weight at all. Now, we've talked about polls before, but just as a refresher, the first thing that we have to talk about when looking at any poll is its sample size. This is the number of people that the poll interviews or asks the question to. Now, in statistics, generally, the greater your sample size, the smaller your rate of error will be. These error rates are seldomly mentioned in the media, but reading the fine print in any poll or any article talking about a poll, you will hopefully find a line that says a sample of this size would carry a margin of error of plus or minus 2.5%, 19 times out of 20. And for somebody who doesn't understand statistics or doesn't really do much reading into these kind of things, you might have no idea what that means. So what that means is that if a poll has a specific sample size, 95% of the time, if people did what they said they were going to do in that poll and went out and voted as was the result in the poll, the number that you see at the end of the day in the public would mirror the numbers in the poll to within 2.5%, 95% of the time. Now, this error rate that I quoted here was a recent poll that was taken in the federal campaign, and it was looking at the error rate of the top-level national numbers. And for those who are looking at the 338 ridings across the country, we need to know that it isn't those top national numbers that decides who wins elections in Canada based on the popular vote. Instead, it's determined in the provinces in each of the 338 ridings, which I guess if you were up late one night trying to fall asleep, you might count them from east to west. The polls will also show results for the provinces and regions, and these provinces and regions will often have their own error rate, which will be higher than the top-level numbers. And nobody really ever talks about that, because this means that, well, we can say a poll has a margin of error of plus or minus 2.5%, it's likely going to have a higher error rate if we're looking at a specific province, specifically to the tune of 4 to 8%, or in some polls that I was looking at just before we began the podcast here, in an excess of 9 to 14%. And because of that, you really have to start asking the question, what is this poll telling us if the parties are all going to be within that 4 to 8, or in the case of this poll we were looking at, 9 to 14% error rate? And this is very important when it comes to polling aggregators, which we'll discuss later. Methods that that the polls use to carry out their surveys can also have an impact on results. Some firms use online sampling, some use interactive voice response, where a computer will call a phone number, and then you will punch in a number on your keypad, and that will be the answer to that poll. And some also use live agents, as in somebody will actually call you up and talk to you about that and take your response down. And some firms also use a hybrid of both. Now, each method has its own benefits and drawbacks, and we should be leery of firms that ultimately combine their polling methods. Now, we've talked about sample size and methods, but another factor that influences your poll is just who you talk to. A pollster hopes to ultimately catch a representative cross-section of the population. And if they don't, they will need to weight their result to represent the recent demographic data or census data from within that region. As in, if you talk to people from Alberta, but you talk to, say, people only from the Edmonton area compared to the Calgary area, you need to weight that appropriately to ensure that you don't skew your results. Same thing can be said for gender, education levels, and also, of course, ethnicity in there. Now, the biggest example of polls being improperly weighted to the voting population and polls being dead wrong we saw happen in the 2016 U.S. election. And it was because of this, polls that were weighting things incorrectly combined with polling aggregators and forecasters that ultimately suggested that Hillary Clinton had an 85% plus chance to win, but we all know what happened there. It turns out that the polls were assuming that turnout for Hillary Clinton would mirror the turnout that Barack Obama had in 2012. And this is going to be a huge issue heading into our election in just over 10 days now, because there's going to be a certain segment of the population getting out to vote, but at the same time, there might not be people that get out to vote because they failed to request a mail-in ballot in time, or they just don't want to go to a polling station in the middle of the pandemic, or they're just fed up with the fact that we have this late summer election that nobody wanted, so they might not vote. And as a result of that, the polls heading into September 20th could be wrong in that same way as well. Now, I mentioned polling aggregators. Polling aggregators average polls that are received from the specific polling firms, and the averages are weighted, meaning that they give certain polls more preference. Now, just how these averages are weighted is determined by the person or group doing the aggregation. And, of course, many people like to cite aggregators saying that X party is going to get A amounts of seats, Y party is going to get B amounts of seats, and so on and so forth. But every person who builds an aggregator will have a different model of their own poll aggregation. And seldomly, these details are made public. This means, in reality, that polling averages live or die based on the person doing them. And unless that person is going to be 100% transparent with their methods, it's impossible to know just how accurate they'll be. Now, going back to the error rate of a single poll, when averaged together, any errors will work their way into the average. And this means that to account for the potential error in one poll, another poll must be exceedingly accurate. We need to also note that in traditional scientific analysis, it's generally frowned upon combining results of studies, let alone studies of different methods and different sample populations and different sample sizes. If you were doing this exact same thing regarding something related to COVID-19, that same study would ultimately find its way to the bottom of the trash heap. Now, for this reason, polling aggregation is a pseudoscience at best. But polling aggregators are very popular because they have also taken to performing seat forecasts, which everybody loves to see, heading into Election Day. Seat forecasts work by looking at what a party averaged in a specific region in previous elections and comparing them to a polling average in the current election. From that, you get a single factor that is determined based on that ratio, and then it's applied to the vote result from the last election in a specific riding to determine what we might expect the vote total to be in the upcoming election. And this is called the proportional swing model that most seat projectors will use. For these to be accurate, we need to make many assumptions. We have to assume the poll is accurate. We have to assume that the voters will actually turn out in those proportional numbers to cast a ballot. Factors like new parties on the scene or turnout enhancing or inhibiting factors can also play a huge role in determining actual outcome. For our purposes here at Western Context, we run these kind of projections internally, but we don't average polls. Instead, we look at each poll individually while applying a healthy grain of salt to the situation. In summary, pollsters have to get it right. They have to get their sample right. They have to have sound methods. They have to have an accurate sample of the voting population. And if not, then weight it correctly. Then you might have an accurate poll, but it all depends on turnout. It's very much like requiring lightning to strike 6 or 7 times in specific spots to get the correct poll. And that's specifically why in 2021, polls should be taken with a hefty grain of salt. And the best answer is to just get out and vote despite what the polls and seat projectors might say.
Yes, and it almost seems like in this last election cycle and in a few of them previously that news medias have been propping up pollsters and their results and what they've come up with as an easy way to get clicks to news and to write about something that really takes no effort for the media and journalists to report on, because all they have to do is look at the results and then make up a narrative that fits that correctly. So they can see a poll that somehow has one party over another, and then all they have to do is come out with a headline that says, oh, party leader is ahead of other party leader by 5%, says new poll. And then all it does is talk about the results. But what it doesn't do is it doesn't talk about the errors, the voting method. It doesn't talk about where in the country that a certain party is doing better than another. It doesn't go into all that nuance. It just talks about how one is supposedly on top. But really, the only poll that really matters is the one on election day. And that's why people shouldn't really be looking at polls to a huge degree on to who they should be voting for. Because as we've so often seen, polls can be wrong, and they can be wrong by quite a bit. And we've seen that many times in Canada, both at the provincial and at the federal level. And, well, you know, there's so many errors. There are snapshots in time for the time that they're taken, but whether they'll still be valid when that election rolls out is often not the case whatsoever.
Yeah, and alongside that, the media narrative built around these polls influences people in a way that they're not aware of, because on the subconscious it happens. If you see the party you're supporting is ahead in the polls, you might be less likely to get out and vote because you feel it might be a done deal. But on the other hand, if a party that you really, really dislike and you might actually be scared of looks to be ahead, that's a motivating factor. Fear is a motivating factor. We need to be 100% clear on that, that in this day and age, there are people in the population on both sides of the political spectrum that see the opposite party as a vehicle of fear. And that's something that the media doesn't talk about with their polls. But lo and behold, a narrative forms that a party might have momentum that can have a huge influence on the people who consume that media. And until you truly understand what happens behind the scenes in a poll, it's only then that you can learn to pop that balloon and treat the poll exactly what it is. And that's a numerical study that has a huge amount of error to it when you start boiling it down to province and even specific riding levels. And that's why we did this story, because there's just so much out there on these polls as we head into the last week of the campaign, and it's something that really needs to be addressed. And if you want to help us do that, I'll just take a moment to remind our listeners about our Patreon page at patreon.com/westerncontext. And there you can support the podcast monetarily if you so choose to, for as little as $2 a month. For that price, you can help us remove bias and sensationalism from the news and media. Or for $5 a month at the price of a sandwich, you can continue to help us do that and have your name read out on the podcast if you want. And for $10 a month, you can become a Western Context insider and gain an insight into our work and gain pre-release access to our production and show notes throughout the entire week. Now, when we reach $30 a month in contributions, patrons will receive an exclusive monthly news article expanding on topical stories of the month, and this article will continue to provide the context and information you've come to expect from us. At $60 a month, you can expect a news and review podcast every other month where we reflect on the news of the month in a candid way and provide opinion on where affairs are headed next. Secondly, if you want to make a one-time contribution as well, you can do that via PayPal. You can figure out how to do that and more at westerncontext.ca/support. So with that being said, we're going to move into our BC story, which is very much a continuation of our COVID story from Alberta last week.
Yes, and for the first time, the BC government is actually releasing data surrounding COVID admissions to hospital. But they're not doing it out of the goodness of their hearts and a love of spreading statistical information to the public. It's because they're wanting people to get vaccinated, and they're wanting to show that a higher percentage of unvaccinated people land in the hospital. But unfortunately, the data that they have released can be viewed in many different ways, depending on your own personal views and your own personal living situation. And we're going to talk about those implications and what they could mean for the province, given the large-scale protests that we saw about a week ago about COVID restrictions and the upcoming vaccine passports, which are due to roll out on Monday. Now, Provincial Minister of Health Adrian Dix said that there are 130 people in intensive care in the province as of yesterday, and of those 130, 111 are unvaccinated, 10 are partially vaccinated, and 9 are fully vaccinated. Moreover, of the fully vaccinated in a BC intensive care unit around the province, of them are under the age of 50. Now, Justin McElroy, who is a local CBC reporter who has made easily accessible graphs and stats known about BC's COVID transmission rate, has just posted his last set of data, as after a year and a half, he is going back to BC Political News in Vancouver. In his own words, he says, quote, "It has been draining and frustrating pushing a government with a $60 billion budget to provide basic accessible data about a deadly pandemic." Now, despite BC's wealth and large budget for healthcare, there is a surprising lack of transparency of statistics from the BC NDP during the pandemic, which is something that the Alberta UCP have been quite open about with their regular release of detailed information about hospital admissions and health comorbidities. Now, the problem with the COVID data that has been released by the BC government is that people can look at it in many different ways. Now, people urging for the vaccines will say, hey, 85% of people in the ICU are unvaccinated, so go get your vaccines and you won't end up in the hospital. While the people in the protests last week will say, hey, there's only 130 people in the ICU out of a province of about 5 million people. Why are these restrictions being constantly forced on us? And there may also yet be a third category of young people and students who are fully vaccinated who might say, hey, there's literally no one in my age demographic in the ICU right now that are vaccinated, so why do I still have to suffer wearing a mask in my hot classroom for hours on end? And, well, that's the problem we're having right now, is the release of this information by the government to get more people vaccinated will not work, because releasing information like this is not going to work on the 20 or so percent of people who have not got vaccinated yet. Our transmission rates have continued to climb despite all the restrictions that have been put back in place, and the 80% of the population who have vaccinated themselves are being punished with more restrictions when we were all told in the spring that getting vaccinated would be the first step to the end of those restrictions. Now, at this point, because of the strain that unvaccinated patients are putting on the ICUs around the province, and due to John Horgan's power grab election last fall, we're going to have to deal with draconian policies going forward. And, well, the one reporter that we've had that has made sure that the public knows about the lack of transparency and accountability from the government won't be covering it anymore. So, in the end, it looks like the end of 2021 will be much the same as the rest of the year.
The interesting side of this story is that when you split the data and you start to look at it, the number one thing that statisticians will say is that an untrained eye will make anything that they want out of the data. And that's precisely what happens on social media with this. But we also, once again, need to do what we do here at Western Context and look at what's not being talked about and what's not being talked about in all these stories relating to ICU capacity is how a surge of about 150, I think it is, in Alberta, 130 people in BC into an intensive care unit can put a huge strain on our healthcare system. And that's a question that's not being talked about, is that why is that happening? What is it with our healthcare system that puts the strain on it? And is there anything we can do either in the short term or in terms of making more resounding structural changes to our healthcare system that would mitigate this? And I don't think there's been a single leader, political or health professional otherwise, who has suggested it. The doctors and the union types will say that we need more restrictions or we need more funding for healthcare. The governments will say that we need more vaccinations and more restrictions. And the people, in the end, get fed up and they lose faith in the process. And when people lose faith in the process, either by not having the data come out or having continual flip-flops, that's how you wind up with more people who are becoming anti-vaxxers in relation to the COVID vaccine and who are not going to be able to get that vaccine going forward because of what the media and the government has done over the pandemic. And it comes back to that horrible question that we asked last week. How many people have the media killed in this pandemic?
Yeah, exactly. And just the whole approach by governments in Canada, and certainly here in BC, to not release information, to not put out what the results have been over the months, has really meant that people have had to go looking for themselves and to search for the needle in the haystack that will show. Because all of the politicians and leaders will say, well, all of the stats that we've released show that vaccines work. But for the minority of the population that haven't got their vaccines yet, statistics like this are not going to help, because all they're being shown is that there is relatively few people in ICUs, and they're seeing these wide sweeping restrictions that are being put in place, regardless of how many people have got their vaccines. So we have to look at different mindsets of people, because not everybody thinks the same way and not everyone believes the same information. So what they have to do is they have to reach out to these people to get them to take their vaccines, but they need to do it in a way that will bring them on board. And what we've seen since the vaccine passports have been released is there's been an overwhelming amount of people that have been applying for the vaccine passports, but there hasn't really been a huge uptick in support for people getting their first or second dose of the vaccine since the program was announced. So we have to say right now, as it stands, from what we've seen, is that the vaccine passport stick approach, as we've seen from the carrot and the stick before, it really hasn't worked, because the numbers just aren't there. And with all the other information that we know about this, you know, there's a lot of information out there that shows that getting vaccinated does keep you out of the hospital. So why are we still having this problem? Well, it comes to the lack of trust that people have had in their government and what they've said over the past year and a half. And that's something that is coming back to bite them now when we're still having problems. And this is the story that really hasn't been talked about, is how much of this is on the government and how much of this is on the media for their constant reporting, fear-mongering, and scare tactics that have driven clicks and ad revenue, but have not really got the proper information out there to the hands of the public. And just now, a year and a half into the pandemic, they're starting to trickle out information to try and support their cause. Well, it's not going to work. And that's something that the media really hasn't been talking about very much, is the approach by the BC government to get people vaccinated has really not worked.
Yeah, and at the end of the day, it comes down to the fact that it's quite honestly too little, too late, and the media won't take responsibility for that because they see themselves as the arbiters of truth. And if you don't believe what they do, well, then you're one of the bad people, according to them, and that doesn't help anyone either. And we're just in a really bad position with this, and nobody has been able to take this and sell all these points to a political base, which is rather unfortunate in Canada. It's definitely something that we need. And when it comes to political bases, they are huge and large, and we don't specifically think of them as having that much influence, but in general they do, whether it's in relation to COVID or the polls. But it's actually also happening at the municipal level here in Alberta, because we've long spoken about the ties of special interest groups and political action committees to what happens in politics in Alberta. And we're moving on to this Alberta story right now. It's going to talk about the Alberta NDP and what they're specifically up to with Edmonton's municipal election coming up, in particular that they want to limit the number of progressive candidates that are running. Now, the Alberta NDP is being fairly egregious in this. They have many ties to union groups, as we've talked about recently on the podcast in relation to the so-called doctors' protests. But this week, we're going to have a look at what they're doing on the municipal level here in Edmonton. Now, on October 18th, Edmonton and Calgary will elect new mayors. And in Edmonton in particular, there's been a push to see more progressives elected. Post Media, through the Edmonton Journal, has obtained emails going back to March of 2020, which suggests that a group called the Elections Readiness Coalition will support and recruit progressive candidates, including training their volunteers. Now, on the surface, you would think that this is just another political group that's operating in the province, but when you delve a little bit deeper, you'll see that the group includes people like NDP MLAs, including former Health Minister Sarah Hoffman, and Rachel Notley's own husband, Lou Arab. Now, Lou Arab is a name we've talked about before. He's with the Canadian Union of Provincial Employees, which for some reason wasn't a conflict of interest, his union ties, that is, while Rachel Notley was premier. And when contacted recently, the Edmonton Journal was told that the group had just fizzled out, and with that, there's quite frankly nothing to see here, they'd like you to believe. But despite this, the group has been actively discouraging candidates to not run for city council. Ward Papastew candidate Kirsten Goa said that she was approached by people within the group trying to convince her not to run in an attempt to ensure that only one progressive candidate would be on the ballot. Ashley Salvador was running in Ward Métis, and she said that she was asked to take part in a nomination process. Yeah, a nomination process, just like the political parties do, that would select the progressive candidate, but she ultimately turned down that request and ran on her own. Now, for those listening outside of Alberta, it needs to be said that for the longest time, our city councils have been largely free of political party influence, and it would seem that the NDP wants to exert their influence at the local level and bring political parties into it. Now, despite the group not meeting for months, those initially involved did receive endorsements from various NDP MLAs. In speaking with Post Media, Sarah Hoffman said her endorsements were based on, as she said, shared values with the candidates. Michael Jans, who is also running in Ward Papastew, said that it's not only that he has been endorsed by the NDP, Rachel Notley's husband, Lou Arab, is actually running his campaign. He said he welcomes the characterization of being an NDP candidate in the race because, in his view, it shows his voters what he stands for. Now, it's at this point we need to be very clear that partisanship in municipal politics is often frowned upon, and in most cases when a third-party group or political candidate inserts themselves, it typically draws fire from the media. This week, we can conclude that the media has no idea that this is happening at the high level, or that it's just been swept away in favor of bigger stories talking about the federal campaign. At the end of the day, though, this underscores the importance that residents do their own research on just who is running to be your next city councilor or mayor. Find candidates that align to your views and ones that aren't running just to run or to push some silly cause. Residents also need to realize that most of these candidates running for mayor and city council have absolutely no idea of what their true powers actually are and think they're much more powerful than they actually will turn out to be. As a result of this, most city councils resemble high school student council bodies because of the excessive power that these candidates in some cases think they will have. This can also be seen as a further building of the beachhead, electing progressive councillors locally, and the NDP may think that this may help them when it comes time for the 2023 provincial election. The NDP's part in this cannot go unnoticed, because if it were the UCP organizing in Edmonton and Calgary, there is no doubt that we would not hear the end of it.
Yeah, this is something that we've seen quite often in BC before, where the provincial NDP in the past has propped up local councillors without actually making it known that they're propping them up. And a lot of these councillors get elected in certain parts of the province, namely in the city of Victoria, as well as in Vancouver. And what they do is then they push policies that are favorable to the local NDP. And we've seen this a few times in the past before. And with no political parties at the municipal level in certain parts, it's more and more difficult for the public to be able to try and discern what a municipal candidate actually stands for ahead of an election that happens. So this is a problem that's not just in Alberta, but it can happen pretty much anywhere. And this is something that a lot of the local media of a particular place doesn't really focus on, because it doesn't drive attention. And it's something that a lot of people have to be worried about when they go to their municipal election polls, is who exactly they're voting for, because a lot of the time people don't really know. And in politics in Canada, a lot of people will just vote for a particular political party because they'll represent a few interests that they believe in. Well, at the municipal level, that likely doesn't happen too often, and a lot of people are running as largely independents. But are they really independent from the bigger parties that are looking for candidates, or they're looking for a beachhead, as you mentioned, into running further elections? Well, as we said, the media doesn't really cover it, so it's hard to figure out exactly what's going on in these particular scenarios.
Yeah, and there is a lot on the line when it comes to the local bylaws and the effect. And the unfortunate side of it is that a lot of the candidates don't specifically talk about that. They focus on a huge grand vision, but they don't realize is that cities in general don't have that much power. And secondly, you are one of 13 people on the council, and whatever the council wants to do, they're going to do. You might not have that much sway in it. So that's why they want to push their political party agenda. And the political parties with their platforms definitely do have a lot to say. And a lot of that gets covered, and a lot of it does not. And in particular, we've seen that on the federal campaign. We have a wonderful firing line segment on this about potential Liberal housing tax.
Yes, now the Trudeau Liberals have some explaining to do on a hot button issue after one of their candidates said that the party will be taxing people who sell their homes. Now, the Conservatives have been claiming for a while that the Liberals will, if reelected, bring in a tax on the sale of primary residences, which is something that is not currently done in Canada. Now, Jason Hickey, who is the Liberal candidate for the riding of New Brunswick Southwest, who is currently held by the Conservatives, John Williamson, was asked about the issue of the government applying a capital gains tax on the sale of primary residences, and he seemed to indicate that it was something that would be done during the online chat with residents of his riding. He said, quote, "But of course, anyone selling their primary residence, if you do make money on that, but unfortunately, you will have to pay tax on that. I wouldn't agree to that either, but it's what we have to do." Now, moments later, when he was asked again about the issue of taxing home sales, this time Hickey said no. He said, "I don't believe we plan on bringing that forth. I don't think we do that." Now, Conservative MP and candidate Pierre Poilievre has said, quote, "Justin Trudeau has claimed that despite a promise in his own platform, Liberals have no plan to tax the sale of your home. However, now we know the truth. Justin Trudeau will just tax the sale of your home only when you decide to sell." Now, earlier this week, Trudeau rejected the idea of taxing the sale on primary residences. He said, quote, "We will not do that. That is something we are not interested in doing." Now, affordability is by far the number one issue in the election, and all parties have tried to address it. O'Toole has had the best reach on this issue, and with a swing in the polls last week, largely attributed to Trudeau's lack of action on the file. Now, the Liberals have tried to add to their campaign housing affordability as one of the party's platforms promises in this year's federal election, even going so far as to promise an anti-flipping tax. Now, to flip a home is to buy and sell it within 1 year, and it's how many of the real estate speculators have made their money at the expense of a majority of Canadians who can no longer afford to buy their own house. But one of the Liberals' candidates in Vancouver, one of the most unaffordable housing markets in the entire world, has been found to have flipped 21 homes since 2005. Talib Noor Mohammed, who is the candidate for Vancouver Granville, originally dodged questions about his flipping activities, saying that he didn't want to speculate on how many rapid-fire real estate deals he's been involved with. Well, new information has come out that said that Noor Mohammed has sold at least 42 properties within Metro Vancouver within the last 17 years, holding 30 of them for less than 2 years. And the tech executive has made a tidy profit along the way, making about $5 million in the process, which is a remarkable $3.7 million of which he's got in the last 6 years. Now, while nothing Noor Mohammed has done is actually illegal, these new documents have painted a far more extensive picture of his real estate activity during an election in which his party leader has described real estate speculation as predatory. Now, of the 42 home sales made by Noor Mohammed since 2005, 21 of them would have qualified for the Liberal anti-flipping tax had it been in place. Now, housing activists have labeled Noor Mohammed's real estate activity as consistent with flipping behavior, in which a person buys a home only to sell it in a short time span for a profit. And flipping has been criticized as one of the contributing factors in rising home prices in Metro Vancouver and throughout the rest of the country. Now, in response to Noor Mohammed's real estate dealings, the NDP is asking Justin Trudeau to clarify whether it's acceptable that a Liberal candidate in Vancouver has made millions of dollars flipping dozens of homes while families and people have paid the price. The NDP are calling on Trudeau to clear the air on whether he knew of Noor Mohammed's house flipping. Now, yet again, we see another case of Justin Trudeau trying to capitalize on a major issue and failing miserably. With all this said, and with his own candidates profiting off a broken system that he is allowed to fester, can anyone trust that he would fix the problem that he had 6 years to address?
And it becomes a very interesting question to talk about, because a lot of people in the housing market buy a house to have that as a way to build value, and eventually at some point later on down the line, post 70, sell the house and put that into retirement, into a retirement fund. And with that, a lot of people do not want to see any sort of tax on a house that they have owned for a number of years because of that. But at the same time, we also, of course, have to look at what this candidate did in Vancouver and see that this is something that happens on the Lower Mainland a lot. And as a result of that, it's something that's causing one of the pain points with affordability. And of course, we look to what the BC government did with the speculation tax. I don't think that's had that much of an impact going forward, but nonetheless, the government of the day has had 6 years to deal with this, and they haven't. Any economist could have told them this was an issue, and it's something they could have rectified without an election. But lo and behold, here we are. So, of course, the question remains on this: is that would they do this if they were reelected again? Given that they have members who have done this in their cabinet, that's a very interesting question, and the bigger question that a lot of people are going to be being worried about with this is that if you have a house and you've had that house for a couple years or less than 5 years and you want to move to something else, are you going to have to pay that tax on it? And it seems to be that there is no clear answer on this. And though they say past behavior is the best indicator of future behavior, we saw that the carbon tax wouldn't go up in 2019 in that race, but lo and behold, it did. So just use that and make your own decision on where this is going next.
Yes, exactly, because as we've seen, this is something that has been going on for quite some time, and whether a political party can actually change what's going on, it will remain to be seen, because so far none of them in power, either at the provincial or the federal level, have been able to do anything to address it. And the cynic will say that that's because a large percentage of the voting population own homes, and people that are going to tax people who own homes will likely find themselves having a drop in the polls because of people not wanting to vote for a party that's going to take money from them. But we'll have to see what the plans in place will be after the election for housing, because this is something that has been going on for certainly the entire length of us doing Western Context since the beginning of 2017. But it's also something that has become even more of an issue now, with so many other things becoming more unaffordable in this latest inflation increase in the past few months or so. And I think that's something that we'll just have to leave in the hands of the listeners to make their own decisions on which party will make the best approach on this one. But as you said, past behavior can be a predictor of future behavior. And that leads us to our word of the week, which is flipping, which is to buy and sell something, which especially real estate or shares, quickly to make a profit. And certainly there's been a lot of flipping in the real estate market in Canada, and it's something that has contributed to the large increase in prices. And, well, flipping also can mean other things, which is to flip from one opinion to another, and can be to get angry very quickly. So flipping, we've seen a lot of that this week, what with Trudeau getting very defensive and angry at the debates. You could say that he flipped out on many different issues. There was also flipping with O'Toole, with him deciding to talk about a certain stance on particular issues and then take another stance a couple days later, and certainly flipping when it comes to housing in Vancouver with the Liberal MP or Liberal candidate there trying to speculate on the real estate and make his living based on rising home prices. And that's something that we've seen a lot in the week, and is something that is going to continue to plague our economy and our housing affordability heading forward.
Yeah, it's a pretty good word of the week, and we'll, of course, be watching this to see if there's any more flip-flops in the last week or on election night, if certain seats flip in any which way direction. So I don't think you can talk about an election without flipping, whether it be flipping seats, flipping positions, or in the case of the Vancouver area candidate, flipping houses. So definitely a good way to sum up this episode of Western Context. And if you want to learn more about it, just check out our full show notes at westerncontext.ca. You can also subscribe to the podcast on any number of podcast listeners out there, Apple Podcasts, Google, Spotify, Pocket Casts, and more. Just visit westerncontext.ca/subscribe. And of course, you can also support the podcast as well, as we talked about in our Patreon segment at westerncontext.ca/support. And of course, we're also on social media, on Twitter and Facebook at Western Context, where we post our shows and some of the stories that we're looking at. So with that being said, we'll be back next week for another episode of Western Context.
I'll always be sure to look through all the stories of the week and talk about what isn't being talked about, and to cover stories in a way that will give you the context that will allow you to make your own decisions and your own informed opinions on certain matters that the media has not been covering. Whether it's in TV, radio, print, or online, we will give you the context needed to put yourselves on the right side of the news. With that said, we'll be back next week for another episode of Western Context.